Hello there. Today is Wednesday, September 20th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, President Trump's first appearance at the UN General Assembly with a warning on what will happen if North Korea continues its provocation.
We will have no choice but to totally destroy North Korea.
Another monster hurricane is leaving death and destruction behind as it churns through the Caribbean. The death toll rising in Mexico's second earthquake. And Hollywood news, including a recap of the Emmy Awards. It's all on today's International Edition. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres opened his first General Assembly gathering Tuesday, warning that North Korea's nuclear ambitions are the world's most serious challenge. Guterres commended the unity of the UN Security Council in its recent imposing of economic sanctions on Pyongyang, saying that the move sends a clear message to the leadership there.
Only that unity can lead to the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula and, as the resolution recognizes, create an opportunity for diplomatic engagement to resolve the crisis. When tensions rise, so does the chance of miscalculation.
Well, he also said fiery talk can lead to fatal misunderstandings, but less than an hour later, President Donald Trump delivered his first UN address with a stern warning.
The United States has great strength and patience, but if it is forced to defend itself or its allies, we will have no choice but to totally destroy North Korea. Rocket Man is on a suicide mission for himself and for his regime. The United States is ready, willing, and able, but hopefully this will not be necessary.
Well, joining me now to discuss is national security expert Jamil Jaffer. So what's your reaction to the president's strong stance and just the speech in general?
Well, look, I mean, I know a lot of people have been very critical of the president's speech, but I think at the end of the day, he made a very clear and bold statement for American leadership in the world, for America's role in the world, and for ensuring that peace and stability, you know, eventually come to pass. And, you know, part of that involves America standing up for its own rights and defending its allies when it comes to that. And the president talked a lot about that and the times in which he was going to use that sort of capability, and at times when he'd be more cautious. And I think he laid out a very clear vision for how America ought to operate in the modern world.
But do you think that his message of America first at a meeting where nations are trying to come together and solve world problems mutually, that was a put-off in some way to some world leaders?
Well, it's interesting, you know, because when he said America first, he said, I'm going to put America first, just like you, each one of you, would put your nations first. And actually, he got applause at that line, you know. And so I think that, you know, he sort of said it the way that I think the average person really thinks about the world, which is, of course, we put our own countries first. That's how we operate. But, you know, at the same time, it's important that allies come together and work together. And he talked about that, too.
A lot of the focus was on North Korea. The president actually threatened to totally annihilate, destroy North Korea, and referred to the leader, Kim Jong-un, in the nickname he used in a tweet, calling him Rocket Man again, before the UN General Assembly. What was your view on his, I don't know if you'd call it tough talk or threatening talk, and is that really the way to resolve a problem with a volatile country like this?
Well, look, Lori, I mean, the reality is that 20 years of bipartisan foreign policy in North Korea hasn't worked. You know, we've tried the cajoling, we've tried the convincing, we've tried the compromising, we've tried the deal-making. None of that has worked with Kim Jong-un or his father, and they've proceeded further towards a nuclear weapon, and now they have a very clear nuclear weapons capability. They appear to be getting what appears to be a hydrogen bomb capability, and they're appearing to be more and more capable of putting it onto a missile and launching that missile long distance almost to the United States. That's a real problem. Look, a North Korea that has nuclear weapons and can hold Los Angeles at risk is not a viable scenario for the United States. And so, you know, something's got to change. Now, the president's tough talk on this thing, I think what it suggests, I think, clearly is that America and the president is willing to consider using military force to deal with this problem. That has to be behind any real credible foreign policy in this area, because without the threat of credible use of force, North Korea is not going to change its behavior, and fundamentally China, which is North Korea's patron, is not going to change its behavior. Now, it doesn't mean we have to use force, but the threat has to be available, and I think the president laid out the case for it being available that he'd be willing to use it. I think all of our hope is that he doesn't use it and that North Korea is willing to negotiate and China is willing to put pressure on North Korea. But at the end of the day, for that to be effective, given that all of our other strategies have not worked, and we cannot accept a North Korea that has nuclear weapons threatening the West Coast or, frankly, any other part of the United States, something's got to change, and this is one credible approach.
But don't you think that he's sort of taunting this guy? I mean, it seems like all it's done is sort of made Kim more defiant.
Yeah, look, the use of the term rocket man and the like, I mean, it is very dismissive, and I think, you know, may even sort of discount the nature of the threat. That being said, I do think that the president was very clear about what his overall policy on North Korea was, and I don't think anybody could leave that speech, anyone in the UN or any North Korean leader or Chinese leader could leave that speech and think the president is not prepared, if it comes down to it, to use force to respond to the North Korean threat. And frankly, that is where we need to be if we're going to get to a negotiated solution to this.
All right. We appreciate your perspective. National security expert Jamil Jaffer. Well, as the Caribbean island nations of Dominica and Guadalupe assess damage after absorbing a direct hit Tuesday from Maria, the extremely dangerous hurricane is now thrashing the U.S. Virgin Islands and expected to make a direct hit to the U.S. territory of Puerto Rico. The U.S. National Hurricane Center says Maria had sustained maximum winds Tuesday of nearly 300 kilometers per hour. Joining me now for an update is Brian Hurley. He's a meteorologist with the Weather Prediction Center. What can you tell us about this potentially catastrophic storm?
Well, right now, Maria is a Category 5 storm with a maximum sustained winds and the latest advisory of 165 miles an hour.
Is it still expected to take a direct hit to Puerto Rico?
Unfortunately, yes, as a major hurricane. And obviously, that's going to bring considerable, well, everything, really, winds. Still some question of whether it's a major hurricane either way, whether it's Cat 4 or 5. We'll have to see about that. And that's certainly listed in the latest advisory, that uncertainty, because of what they call an eyewall replacement cycle. But either way, it's going to be a very damaging storm, unfortunately, to Puerto Rico. And with that, certainly not just the wind, but the surge, and as well as the rainfall, looking at the rainfall amounts easily, many areas getting 12 to 18 inches and some localized amounts up to 25 or so, maybe a little bit more in those mountainous areas.
When do you expect it to be the worst there?
Right. Well, right now, it looks like the worst is going to be Wednesday afternoon. It looks like around 2 o'clock, 1 to 2 o'clock, looks like the core of the eye wall will be going over Puerto Rico. So just deteriorating conditions between now and then, because they are already starting to get some of those outer bands.
How catastrophic would a storm like this be?
Well, for Puerto Rico, it's been a long time since they've been affected directly by this. 1928 was their strongest hurricane up to this point. So,
and is this bigger?
Or just as big. So nobody knows really the size because it was so long ago, and they didn't really study them as much. But boy, you're talking, 89 years?
What happens after Puerto Rico? Is it still too soon to know whether this storm might hit the U.S. mainland?
The confidence is growing that it'll make the more of that northwest to eventually north-northwest turn. So in other words, it's going to do, unfortunately, hopefully not irreparable damage to Puerto Rico, but it will also skirt Hispaniola. It looks like the Dominican Republic is going to basically skirt the northern side of it and then make that right turn towards the Turks and Caicos. So that's an area that we're also watching. But pretty much as it goes more north-northwest at that point, stay east of the Bahamas. And that's still in the forecast, taking us through the weekend. And beyond that, as we get into next week, still a lot of uncertainty as to where it's going to go. Certainly part of the reason why the National Hurricane Center only goes out to 5 days in these forecasts.
Could this potentially just literally flatten Puerto Rico with the impact of such a huge storm?
It's large enough, and the thing that could help certainly is the terrain, especially those taller mountains in the south. You know, depending on the track, that could help areas towards San Juan and on the northeast coast. It really does depend on where that eye wall is going to cross. Now, this system is by no means as large as Irma was. That could potentially help too. Mm-hmm. Yeah, as you know, the wind field on Irma was pretty broad, and when I say wind field, those hurricane force winds extended well away from the eye of Irma. And it's not the case this time around. However, Puerto Rico just got nicked with Irma. This is more of a direct hit. So, yeah, it's going to certainly be more impactful for Puerto Rico, unfortunately, and for those islands before getting to Puerto Rico.
All right. Brian Hurley, meteorologist with the Weather Prediction Center. Thank you so much. Well, as if another dangerous hurricane weren't enough, Mexico now suffering another massive earthquake. Jane Lee tells us the 7.1 magnitude quake hit Mexico City Tuesday afternoon, collapsing buildings, killing scores of people, and trapping an unknown number of others in the wreckage.
Images of the damage showing building walls shearing off and floors collapsed. It's the second big quake to hit Mexico this month. The quake's epicenter was near Mexico's southeastern city of Atencinco, according to the U.S. Geological Survey.
VOA's Andrew Palchewski says it's also creating a lot of reaction on social media.
We saw right after it happened video from skyscrapers that could overlook the city that showed plumes of smoke coming up from throughout the city. And we later saw video emerge of exactly what was happening with those plumes of smoke. It was buildings collapsing. And of course, everybody today has a smartphone, so people, after they were evacuated from these buildings, standing on the street, are filming them, and you start to see them move a little bit, and all of a sudden some of these buildings start to come down. There were three or four videos I saw where people were standing there filming it as apartment buildings or office buildings came down and created a plume of smoke. There's fears that other buildings may collapse, and lots of people talking about that on social media.
Dealing with another earthquake, what was it, a week ago?
Yeah, two earthquakes in as many weeks. So a lot of speculation that initial earthquake may have weakened things, and this may be causing additional buildings to collapse. But we're also seeing scenes of humanity in the midst of this devastation. Out of the rubble, people are running in, trying to rescue people. People are offering their hopes and prayers, but it unfortunately looks like the death toll may rise in this case. But we're certainly going to monitor that on social media.
All right, VOA's Andrew Palchewski, thank you so much for the update. You can follow him on Twitter at APAL. You can also follow the International Edition stream at VOA_IE. Here are some of the stories we're following at VOAnews.com. Analysts say military options against North Korea are fraught with danger. A third suspect is arrested in London subways bombing. The U.S. Navy blames recent collisions on operations pace and failure to prioritize safety. And Cuba, again, denies its role or any role in health attacks on U.S. diplomats. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. The cable news network is reporting that government investigators wiretapped the former chair of President Trump's campaign under a secret court order issued prior to the 2016 election, and then again after the election. Separately, the New York Times reports federal agents picked the locks on Paul Manafort's house during a raid earlier this summer. Manafort served as Trump's campaign manager for about 2 months, but was forced to resign after reports surfaced about his business relationship with the former leader of Ukraine. According to CNN, the new warrant was related to an FBI investigation into contacts between the Trump campaign and Russians. Joining me now to talk more about this is criminal defense attorney and former CIA agent Jack Rice. So how significant is this latest development?
It's incredibly important. When the FISA court comes out and they come out swinging, the standard is high in the sense of what they're doing, why they're doing it. But what's even more important in this case was this investigation was taking place. The warrant took place before the election, and then they started it again subsequently, which really says that they were looking at exactly what was going on with the Russians and Manafort and connections to this White House.
The FISA warrant, how difficult is it to get one of those, and what exactly is it?
The FISA warrant goes back decades now, but essentially it's designed to provide a separate process to get warrants when it comes to intelligence-related issues and national security-related issues. Do they issue them? They absolutely do, but they also take them extremely seriously, and they think about what they're doing in order to get them. So it's not just something that they issue because somebody's in the mood. There is a very specific standard, and it goes all the way to the top in Justice Department when they're looking at these issues. It's not just done at low levels, and it's not just done by people who don't know what they're doing.
So if they get one, it's a big deal.
Yeah, it's a big deal.
Does it mean that they've got something that's very incriminating?
Generally, in order to get a warrant like this and to get any warrant, you have to show that you have something very specific that you're searching for and something that makes you think that a crime was committed. You're not just doing this as a fishing expedition. You have more than that. And in fact, it really highlights the fact that they pulled back on the warrant issue before the election because they thought maybe they didn't have enough. And then subsequently, they came back. And that highlights that they look at this stuff seriously. They look at the broad-based circumstances, and they start driving back in based upon what they know and what they think they can find out. It's not based upon saying, gosh, maybe we'll find something hypothetically, so we'll just check it out. They don't do it that way.
It looked like the wiretap included a period of time when Manafort was actually talking to Trump. Do you think it's possible that there are tapes of the two of them talking?
Yes, I do think it's possible that the president may have been taped alongside Manafort. And again, the real question now is, if you look at this effort to continue the FISA warrant on Manafort, and I think what they were concerned about was that this Russian effort, which I think is quite clear, not only in general, but specifically involving Manafort and others, the question is where this goes, who else was involved, who was connected? Did this potentially go all the way up to the Oval Office itself? I think those are questions that investigators are trying to understand right now. And frankly, getting this warrant at this time was about trying to determine that.
Hillary Clinton, in an interview on Monday with NPR, said that she wouldn't rule out questioning the legitimacy of the 2016 election if Russian interference is deeper than they currently know about. What do you make of that? Is it even possible that the legitimacy of the election could be questioned and overturned?
That strikes me as unlikely that something like that could happen. But what it really does highlight is a much broader point, and that is the legitimacy of an election. If you have a foreign power who has stepped in to manipulate that election and even to potentially manipulate one of the candidates themselves, does that undercut the absolute credibility of that individual? Absolutely, it does. Does it rise to the level that you would actually overturn an election? That strikes me as unlikely at best, but it would highlight the point of the legitimacy of the individual who was supported by an adversary.
We don't hear anything from Mueller. We just hear dribbles of whatever may be happening behind the scenes with this investigation. But interestingly, Newsweek has an article that says Mueller's team is slowly surrounding Trump as prosecutors might treat a mob boss. What do you take from that?
If you think about how justice went after multiple crime families over the last several decades. They started looking at this not just in terms of the crimes that were actually committed, but in terms of some of the tax issues, some of the obstruction issues. And that's exactly what they're doing in this particular case. They're following the money, they're following the obstruction, and they're following essentially the ability to deny and obfuscate. And that's what we saw with crime families in the past. And that's exactly what Mueller and his people are doing. He just hired an additional prosecutor who is a pro. I mean, multiples. They're at 17 or 18 now. And these guys, men and women, who are really extraordinary and really good at what they do. And I can tell you honestly, the last thing I would want to be is a target of that investigation because of just how good these people are.
All right. Criminal defense attorney and former CIA agent Jack Rice. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
The United Nations General Assembly is meeting in New York, and VOA Africa is providing extensive coverage. We'll hear from world leaders about today's pressing issues. News of the latest developments, along with analysis. VOA Africa, your trusted source of news and information.
Hello, sports fans. This is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports. For detailed information about your favorite sports, visit our website, voaafrica.com. And if you want to chat with me and sports fans in Africa and all over the world, visit my Sunny Side of Sports Facebook page. There, the sports talk never stops. So come on, join the action with the Sunny Side of Sports.
VOA's International Edition continues now as we turn to Hollywood news. And for that, we're joined by Rare.us content editor Nicole Moschella. Hi, Nicole. So we just got done with the Emmy Awards or a few days ago, and there's been a lot of talk about that in the show. But you've actually got a side story, huh?
Yes, Donald Glover. He won not one, but two Emmy Awards on Sunday night. The first one was for Best Comedic Actor, and the second was for Best Director in a Comedy Series, both of which are from his series Atlanta. And the second one, the Best Director Award, he made history because he was the first Black director to ever win an Emmy Award in that category. And also, just off of that, it's been 32 years since a Black actor got an Emmy Award for Best Comedic Actor. The last time was 1985. So it's pretty remarkable for him. People were very, very excited about it. And it also was a big night for women. There were a lot of women in Hollywood, especially. There were a lot of series this year, including HBO's Big Little Lies and Veep, and a Netflix series called Black Mirror, specifically the San Gernapeno episode, which revolved around strong female leads. Those shows all swept the Emmys this year, and Nicole Kidman won for her role in Big Little Lies, and she played a domestic abuse victim and actually mentioned domestic violence on the stage as she was accepting her Emmy. She said, "Domestic abuse is a complicated, insidious disease that exists more than we allow ourselves to know." And people were applauding her for mentioning that. But on a lighter note, she did dedicate it to her two children and her husband, Keith Urban.
Okay, so we've got the Emmys covered, and I understand, again, you've got some news about the royals. Boy, that just keeps coming. What's going on?
Yeah, the royal family, I guess, after Queen Elizabeth, the royals of family plans on changing things, I guess, when Prince Charles becomes King Charles. There's word right now that he does not plan on using Buckingham Palace as his primary residence, as his mother, Queen Elizabeth II, does right now. I guess when he becomes king, he plans on using it more for office space, and they're calling it monarchy headquarters. So it'll be more for all of his royal duties, as well as he plans on opening it for tourism. Right now, it's only open 3 months out of the year. There's talks of his plans to open it for 6 months. And apparently, people are saying that maybe Prince William kind of has the same kind of views. They just don't think it's really economical to keep the upkeep of Buckingham Palace. I guess they're both feel at home at their current residences. Charles lives with his wife Camilla at Clarence House, which is just across from Buckingham Palace. So I guess they plan to stay there after he becomes king and open up the palace for more official business and tourist traffic.
All right. Very cool. Thank you so much. As always, that's Rare.us content editor Nicole Moschella. Well, a popular young singer has struggled with health problems in recent years. VOA's Border Crossings host Larry London joins International Edition's Sarah Williams to talk more about it.
Selena Gomez, who has a new song which she just released, and we'll check it out in a minute, called Fetish. But first, what's made news is the fact that Selena, who was diagnosed with lupus several years ago, recently underwent a kidney transplant operation. She kept it very quiet. It happened at the beginning of the summer. A lot of fans were asking, why aren't you out promoting your upcoming new album and your new music? And they kind of thought she was slacking. But she finally revealed to her 120-plus million Instagram followers that the real reason was she had a kidney transplant. The kidney was donated to her by one of her best friends, who's an actor, Francia Raisa. And so they love each other. She referred to her as sisters. Obviously, it takes a big step to give somebody your kidney, one of your organs. But apparently, the kidney is resistant to lupus. It's functioning very well, and Selena's doing very well, which is great because she, a year ago, checked herself into rehab over anxiety and depression, which she said is a part of having lupus. So she's bounced back, and now today we're going to check out a new song called Fetish.
I'm not surprised, I sympathize. I can't deny your appetite.
Is she going to be able to tour? Is her health improving?
Well, her health is improving. That's the big question right now, is how's she doing? She's been spotted recently in New York City where she's filming a movie. She's appearing in the next Woody Allen film. So she's been filming there on set and has a house in New York. And apparently her boyfriend, The Weeknd, has moved in with her. So they're sharing the house in New York. And she's slowly but surely releasing music. The new song we just heard is called Fetish. And that follows several other singles that she's put out. Good For You, It Ain't Me, Bad Liar. These are songs she's slowly been releasing this year. She has been telling her fans she has a new album coming out. We don't know what it's called or when it will be out. And I'm sure there will be a tour to follow the new album, which is kind of standard procedure in the business. When you release an album, you tour to support it. But she recently celebrated her 15th anniversary of her debut on Barney and Friends. She was a little girl on a little kid's TV show when she was hired for her first acting job. And so that was 15 years ago. And then last week, she celebrated the 10th anniversary of her days on a Disney TV show called Wizards of Waverly Place. She was 15. She's now 25. She said that she recalls when she was 15 being on the beaches after just premiering on Wizards of Waverly Place, where men, grown men photographers and the paparazzi were taking her photos wearing a bikini. And she thought that was invasive. She said, I'm 15. What do you want with me? She didn't realize the price that comes with fame,
yes,
which she's been paying ever since. Of course, from her much publicized relationship with Justin Bieber and all the other things been going on in her life. So Selena Gomez is in the spotlight for today on the International Edition segment. And the new song is called Fetish.
All right. Thanks very much, Larry. That's Larry London. He's the host of VOA's Border Crossings. You got a fetish for my love.
You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thank you so much for listening, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Daryl Smith. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The U.S. Department of the Treasury announced targeted sanctions on two South Sudanese government officials and one former official for their roles in threatening the peace, security, or stability of South Sudan. Three companies that are owned or controlled by one of the officials were also sanctioned. The measures taken against Malik Ruben Riak Rengu, Michael Makui Lewith, and Paul Malong Awan make clear that the U.S. government will impose consequences on those who expand the conflict and derail peace efforts. The Treasury Department also released a Financial Crimes Enforcement Network advisory alerting U.S. financial institutions to the possibility that certain South Sudanese senior political figures may try to use the U.S. financial system to move or hide proceeds of public corruption. The United States stands ready to impose other measures against those responsible for undermining the peace, security, or stability of South Sudan. As the advisory demonstrates, the United States is committed to increasing scrutiny on those who enrich themselves through corruption, while the South Sudanese people suffer through economic hardship and a dire humanitarian crisis. 6 million people in South Sudan, half of the population, face life-threatening hunger, while more than 4 million people have been displaced from their homes, including 2 million refugees. This is a man-made crisis and one the government of South Sudan can stop, said State Department spokesperson Heather Nauert. We continue to make clear to South Sudan's leaders that they must honor their declared ceasefire, revive the 2015 agreement on the resolution of the conflict in the Republic of South Sudan by engaging meaningfully with opposition parties, bring an end to atrocities, stop the harassment of aid workers, stem human rights abuses, cooperate fully with the United Nations mission in South Sudan, and take action against corruption, said Ms. Nauert. The United States urges all parties to engage constructively in the upcoming South Sudan peace process.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.